Welcome back to the Get Cyber Resilient Show. This week is our Behind the News episode. I'm Dan McDermott, your host for today, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity expert, Garrett O'Hara. Today, we'll be looking behind the news of how the alleged criminals stung by the Anom app sting last year are questioning the evidence's lawfulness. Then, we'll look at how prominent password management company LastPass has once again suffered a hack. Next, we'll dive into how a ransomware attack against a software company in the UK has struck the NHS across the country, with patient data may have been their target. And we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Gar, welcome to episode 110. Let's begin by unpacking the story of how the cyber sting using the Anom app is being challenged for the legality of the evidence obtained using this method.
Yeah, we're back to the movie. You know, this is the story that you and I talked about last year that I can't believe they haven't already made the movie, but maybe they have to wait until all the court cases are finished. But for those who don't remember, the Anom encrypted communications thing was with the FBI. They called it Trojan Shield. The AFP called it Ironside. In Europol, it was Greenlight. It was across, I think it was lots of different countries. I think the rest ended up being in 16 different countries. But I think the actual app itself was used in about 100. Huge kind of uptake of the app. Would have actually been a really successful commercial enterprise, actually, if the cops ever decided to do that. But you know, it is a movie. This is an encrypted app that took over. There was a Canadian one that kind of went either out of business or got shut down or something. And what happened was the FBI had a guy who was pretty much, I believe, going to go away for the rest of his life to live in a very small cell. And instead, they co-opted him into kind of working with them for this encrypted communications app or device, really. And so they seeded it. I think actually it seeded in Australia first, but it basically went worldwide. And you saw lots of organized criminals using it to arrange, basically their activities. And there's some screenshots in some of the media that have reported in this story. And it feels kind of a really interesting window into how normal some of the communications actually is. You know, in one of them, the criminals are talking about what I suspect is a very large drug shipment, but also one of them felt ill and, you know, was kind of like, oh, I hope you're feeling better. And can you pick up the drugs? You know, it's just a weird juxtaposition of illegal activity and criminality. But this thing has been out there for quite some time. The sting itself was actually really, really successful. They got over 40 tons of drugs, which is probably about the amount that would get done in a weekend in Sydney, from what I understand, but huge amount of drugs. Luxury cars, 55 of those, lots of guns, lots of currency and cryptocurrency. So a really, really huge haul. I think the AFP said it was the biggest organized sting operation that they had ever run. So massively successful. And the idea with the device, by the way, and sort of history lesson here, but if people are like me, they forget these things pretty easily. But these devices, basically, you could access the Anom app through the little calculator app. So you'd put in a particular number in the calculator app, and it would open up the communications sort of channels or whatever, the secret channel for communication. And it had sort of cool stuff. You know, if it didn't get used in a certain amount of time, it would delete all the communications. Or if you put the wrong pin in, it would delete all the communications. So quite clever if you're a criminal, sort of the brochure. I'm not a criminal, but like if I was, the brochure definitely it would have been appealing. And how it worked was, say you and I are doing a drug deal or whatever, and you're wherever, I message you. What was happening was essentially like a blind carbon copy was getting sent to a server in Romania and then re-encrypted and sent off to law enforcement. So they just got to see a huge amount of communication between criminals all around the world. And in Australia, there was 224 people arrested. There was 526 total charges, so very successful by all measures. But this story has just hit this month, and it's really around the admissibility of the evidence. And, I probably say this all the time. I'm not a lawyer, don't really get this stuff, so I don't really get what makes something admissible or not. But it potentially throws into, question whether, these people are going to be charged or not because of the admissibility. That's a hard word to say, the admissibility of the evidence.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to remove your sort of your criminal hat and put on your lawyer cap, but you said you've sort of thrown that one away already today. But it is very interesting, right? Because now the entire case is based on the legality of the evidence that they've acquired during this, which means it's now an all or nothing really as to how the case goes from here. So all of those charges, obviously, you know, stick, and then, you know, we'll probably come to some sort of, you know, criminal findings, or the whole thing goes away in one go if it's deemed that the evidence is inadmissible.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. The questions that are being asked around it are, like, how reliable is the actual evidence that's been gathered through the app? And I mean, that's probably a legitimate question to ask. You know, it's a sort of bespoke application that's created by police or, you know, law enforcement, I should say. But, like, how do you actually know that it is what it is and it hasn't been modified in some way? You know, in our business, we talk about things like the chain of custody and how, you know, when you talk to somebody who's in digital forensics and incident response, the level they go to photograph a scene before they even touch a computer, they'll take photos, they, you know, of the cables, of the computer monitor, everything. And everything is documented, everything that's touched is documented, every change is documented. And they'll often do things like take an image of the drive so that they're not, you know, dealing with the original drive and sort of can do analysis without trying to potentially changing things. So, and I know from talking to people in digital forensics and incident response how incredibly onerous a lot of the processes are around ensuring evidence is usable in court and that idea of admissibility. So, yeah, again, like, this is such a new thing to use an encrypted app that's been put out there by the FBI. I think they actually bought, and I think I'm correct here, but I think they actually bought a commercial operation and used that as a way to kind of distribute the app. So, you know, maybe questions around that also. But, you know, that idea of how reliable is the evidence, and then also the kind of legality of law enforcement getting the evidence without a warrant in many cases, because, you know, this is a very wide net that they've cast, and anyone who kind of lit up and started using the app became part of the analysis of communications, which is a little bit different, or maybe a lot different, versus, you know, if the cops know that you and I are doing something bad, that, well, they can get a warrant to say we want to intercept communications between Dan and Gar. And that's the scope of the warrant. Whereas in this case, it's an app, and really potentially lots of people got caught up in it who weren't criminals. From reading around on this and doing the research, it sounds like, to me anyway, if you're on this app, pretty good chance you weren't sort of arranging drinks in the local pub, and it was actually, you know, other stuff.
No, indeed. And it reminds us a little bit back of the sort of the Patriots Act, right, of listening first and acting second, which obviously then has gone away for a whole range of reasons that we've spoken about before. But there is a precedent in Finland where a Finnish court actually threw out a case based on messages gathered from the Anom app. So they've started to make a ruling there about, you know, about the fact of, as you say, like, because there wasn't warrants involved and that type of thing, does that mean that the police are even in a position to be able to act on the information that they've received? And that is sort of the questions that are being asked at the moment in the Supreme Court here in Australia. But there's also, you know, already talk about the fact that it won't end here. Like, whatever happens in this current case, it will probably then be appealed, because it is such a grey area of law as well. And so there will always be, you know, holes that each side will sort of look to poke into the other, and it will probably get through and end up being a high court judgment at some point. And that will become, you know, really critical, because then that will be the precedent for everything else. So really, it's going to set the scene for, I guess policing and law enforcement and the use of cyber as part of that for a long time to come.
Totally agree. And it raises questions also around, you know, in this case, they created an app that they controlled with, you know, backdoor BCC and comms out to the law enforcement agencies. But, you know, it's an ongoing conversation here and in other kind of countries around the protection of end-to-end encryption for, you know, citizens talking to each other and the right to privacy. And, you know, how many times you and I have talked about this one on the show, and I'm clearly on the side of end-to-end encryption. I, you know, believe privacy should trump, you know, the ability for mass surveillance. But, more and more you kind of you see the shift going towards some sort of backdooring of end-to-end encryption so that law enforcement on a warrant basis can go and intercept communications between two, you know, sender and recipient. And I'd probably be comfortable with that if I thought for a second it wouldn't get overused. And like, when we've talked about this nearly every time, there's examples where when you go back over the data, you know, for the previous many year, X many years, you can see that there's been overreach after overreach and process hasn't been followed. And, you know, they're using it for things that they were never really designed for. And, you know, Apple is a company that they're actually walking back a little bit from their stance as, you know, the privacy sort of vendor. You know, you see the billboards around Sydney, which, you know, again, support that. It's a good thing, privacy. But they have started to look at ways to help law enforcement. And, you know, in their case, I think the potential for child abuse is the big issue for them. And, you know, doing things like scanning images and notifications if something that is, and this is good stuff, right? I mean, an image that matches and a known bad image, awesome. And like, if it's going to stop that stuff, brilliant. But I think the widespread breaking of ETA, end-to-end encryption, there be dragons.
Well, as you mentioned, I think with this one, if you were on the app, it was probably for a reason, right? And probably, you know, like I certainly, you know, never heard of it until it had broke the news for all the wrong reasons. So it's one of those ones where that does feel like it is somewhat different and that they've opted into this communication vehicle, you know, for nefarious purposes. So you feel as though there's something in that, but who knows? The legalities will have a long way to play out. And I'm sure it's one that, you know, we'll be able to keep the audience abreast of what happens from here in terms of some of those findings. And as I said, I'm sure in time, you know, sort of appeals through to the High Court and an ultimate finding there as well.
So we shouldn't expect to see you doing a perp walk, Dan, because you're like, if I had a bet of somebody in Mimecast who's going to be the Heisenberg, like Breaking Bad, that you, like you were always it in my mind. We were going to find out you were a billionaire drug dealer on the side and, you know, senior director for marketing was just a cover story.
Thanks for outing me there, yeah. But as I think most people would know, that seems somewhat unlikely, but anyway. So yes, I don't think I'll be caught on the Anom app, that's for sure. The next story that we have is how source code of password management company LastPass has been accessed by a hacker. Now, Gar, I believe this is not the first time that they've fallen foul of this.
Yeah, they've had a little run of things happening. So I'm a LastPass customer, so, you know, in the interest of disclosure, I like the software and I'm a huge password manager of any sort and big fan of those. Please go get yourself a password manager. Friends don't let friends not use password managers. So I got the notification, Jan's. For obvious reasons, you have a little bit of a heart flutter because of what it potentially means if something really bad has happened. And look, in this case, there was an incident. Their dev environment seems like that got popped through a single developer's account, and there was some code stolen and some IP around, you know, how LastPass works and stuff like that. But no customer data, no access to passwords. Breathing sighs of relief all around, I'm sure, for everybody who's involved. And LastPass, I'm guessing probably most of the password managers operate on a zero knowledge model anyway. So the reality is, like, you have your phone device and it encrypts the data essentially using AES-256. So they don't have visibility of your master password at all. So the reality is, like, there probably is fairly little risk. I hate saying that because as soon as I say that, somebody way cleverer than...
we'll find a way.
Yeah. It's always the way, right? But, you know, it is zero knowledge. So from that respect, you know, the device holds the sort of key to being able to get access to the stuff on the cloud, which is where that stuff is stored. So if people are using browser extensions or their phones or whatever... That's kind of how that works. So, you know, if I'm a customer, I feel okay about it. I'm not really too worried. But it does kind of raise the question of, like, what would it mean if somebody did figure out some way to do this? And it would not be a good day. I think I've probably got like 50 passwords on there and I don't even know what they are. So it would literally be going through and resetting 50 different accounts and oh, it'd be an absolute nightmare. But look, to your points, LastPass, it's not the first time they've heard the news about some, you know, incidences that have happened. And I think part of this is just the fact of like what they are and who they are makes them, first of all, very appealing as a target. You know, it's the famous quote, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. And if you think about it, if anyone did successfully breach LastPass or any password manager, that is a treasure trove of information and stuff that is just incredibly useful. 2021, they saw what seemed to be an exposure of master passwords, but LastPass kind of came back and said, actually, they're pretty sure it was just credential stuffing. So that's where you basically throw a bunch of username and passwords that have been breached somewhere else at a site until you find one that works. There was an outage in 2020, and weirdly, it was only for accounts that were older than 2014. Did affect some people. It was all over Twitter and whatnot at the time. And then in 2019, a Project Zero researcher found a bug that exposed creds from sites that you previously visited. So they've had stuff, but nothing, you know, that to me anyway, as a non-pen tester, you know, hardcore security person, you know, I feel pretty comfortable with it, especially with the zero knowledge model and the encryption stuff that's in there. And the reality is, it is far more secure than me having the same useless password across all of my accounts anyway. I mean, that's the worst case scenario because they just need to get one password and they've got everything. And with this, I love the fact that I don't know my password for anything. Like it's such a lovely feeling not having to remember that stuff. So I think, there's huge value in password managers. And then you and I mean, how many times now have we talked about the future of this stuff and, you know, that we'll, you know, hopefully eventually get to go to passwordless and Fido.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that it's like, you sound like you already live in a Fido world where you're not really relying on the passwords anyway. They're there because they're a necessity in order to access what you need to access. But in terms of the way that you're utilizing it isn't, you know, having your mother's maiden name and birthday, in case I just got that wrong, as your password for everything, right? So there's always those sort of things. So it's definitely seems as though, like you say, I think it's partly newsworthy because of who they are and that potential of, you know, there's a bit of scare factor in this, right? Of like, ooh, passwords, you know, all your passwords are out on the web and they're going to be able to be accessed. That's something that is, you know, does certainly heighten everybody's interest and makes everybody quite paranoid, and therefore, you know, does bring into question, I guess, sort of the legitimacy of some of these technologies and that. So I certainly think that more than anything, it is it's the potential sort of newsworthiness, if you like, unfortunately, for the wrong reasons, that does make it seem to come up and hit sort of, you know, more sort of towards mainstream news and certainly large IT news than maybe what it deserves based on what's actually happened in some ways as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. There's one thing in password managers that I want to call out because I'm an evangelist for these things. As you might have noticed, I'm a big fan. And some of my friends have come back and told me how they use them is that they create the passwords and literally just use them to store the password. And for the listeners, I'm sure anyone who's listened to this show won't do that, but what you want is the password manager to choose a really long, incredibly random password, which they can do way better than a human being can do. So it's not a storage device, it's a password creation and storage device. So just for people who are listening, that's kind of an important part of how these things work.
Indeed, that's right. I mean, it creates that, security out of the gates, if you like, right? And then that's why it even makes it even more important that it can't be breached and therefore accessed because, you know, you're just like you don't remember that and you rely on it to access your stuff. If that gets breached, then everybody else can do that as well. So definitely one to always keep an eye out on. But, you know, thanks for the public service announcement around password management as well, Gar.
Anytime.
The final deep dive story for this week is the attack impacting the NHS in the UK, where a supply chain attack against a software supplier called Advanced has impacted health services and potentially breached patient records. What's happened here, Gar?
Yeah, good old supply chain, eh? Rears its ugly head time and time again. Yeah, so the software supplier's name Advanced, and they're used by the NHS, so broadly and widely across the UK. And things like patient referrals, notes on patients, how they dispatch ambulances, making appointments out of hours. Some of the mental health services use this stuff, and also for things like emergency prescriptions. So very broad set of uses that that are sort of engaged for with the advanced software. So when you're reading kind of through all the stories on this, some like really sad stuff where people are in with you know, their kids who have mental health issues, and you know, the doctor can't access any notes and, you know, has nothing to work on. And like, I find these ones really difficult. Not that it's not horrible when companies lose money and that stuff, like it absolutely is, but there's something really, really human and just kind of awful about the impact to, you know, just human beings going around their day looking for healthcare. And, you know, whether that's, you know, somebody with mental health issues or somebody in an emergency, like how awful would it be that you can't get the help you need because somebody's looking to, you know, make some Bitcoin out of a ransomware attack. So it's just kind of gross that this stuff is happening. And kind of a worrying comment from the company that, you know, it could be 12 weeks before some of these services are back online. And that sort of points to the issue of, you know, we talk about cyber resilience and actually last week, you know, we talked about this idea of the impact and the importance of response and how critical that is. So not just building a big wall, but actually what to do when an attack is successful. And this is maybe a good example of that where, you know, awesome, have technical controls and work with the supplier to get their software back online. But having the kind of secondary services, and in this case, it seems like paper is the way to go. And that can be fine. It's not, we're actually not even part of the stories for this week, but in the US, some of the, I think it's the DOD, are actually looking at going back to paper for some of the really highly confidential stuff, believe it or not. So they're actually moving away from digital because paper is seen as potentially a really, really secure way of, I think it was in cases, like in court cases where the DOD is looking at that anyway. But you know, the point there being, when you think about resilience, that is a broad conversation and it needs to take into account all the workflows in an organization, the data, what are the things that need to get done, and figuring out ways to at least get those critical services and the critical data usable. And, you know, hopefully that gets you navigating through the incident, reduces some of the pressure, and, you know, as you respond to the ransomware attack. So it is a real worry how long it's going to take. And then, you know, one of the people commenting in one of the articles was saying that it could take 6 months to actually then process and input all the backlog of stuff that they've created manually in terms of patient records, which apparently is, you know, a few hundred thousand. And, you know, there's a huge overhead in terms of workload when you think about how impacted most industries and verticals are through lack of people, and, you know, the great resignation and mm-hmm. COVID and all the things that are going on around the world. Like, the last thing you need is something that then requires more employee time. Being healthcare, obviously there's a bunch of people who are volunteering their time to try and get things going again. But it's a real it's just an awful story.
Yeah, and like you say, that notion of resilience and what does that actually mean? I mean, in this instance, you know, these are critical time sensitive services, right? And so that's the first thing is that therefore your backup to be able to continue to operate needs to be fairly immediate, right? Otherwise, you know, it has significant, like you say, human impact on that. So definitely that resilience notion of having something that to fall back upon quickly is incredibly important. But like you say, if paper might be look like the answer, and it might be the answer in terms of being able to do that quickly and move, but then that's creating the downstream effect of gathering all that information and then updating the records once they're back up online. So, you know, it's like you're sort of solving one thing, but you're creating another problem as you move forward with that as well. So, you know, these are not easy, and, you know, it's a non-trivial thing to actually work through, but it's critically important, you know, particularly in this space where, you know, literally lives are dependent upon the decisions that are being made around the technologies and the backup and the process and what you have there. So, you know, a really critical one. And obviously there's this impact of the services themselves, Gar, but also interested in, like, you know, has actual patient records been breached, and is that really the end game as to, you know, what these cyber criminals were after.
I think that's to be established in this case. So I don't know that they know that for sure just yet. I mean, potentially we're seeing that more and more, right, with ransomware attacks. They tend to be two-pronged these days, you know, where you lock up the data, but you also exfil at least some of it so that you can sell it on. And we know that private health information is extremely valuable online. So if you're going to steal anything, it tends to be kind of the premium data, you know, on the dark web. So, you know, it's definitely there. And kind of thinking about what you just said there, Dan, like that downstream effect, one of the things that's going to happen there is the potential for data entry issues. You know, you're introducing humans to copy handwritten notes, and doctors are pretty famous for how bad their handwriting is. So, you know, and you know, that part of it's funny, but the potential for somebody to have something not go well for them because somebody typing in notes misunderstood something in them, yeah, like that's certainly there. Actually, in the paper stuff, you've just reminded me also of one of my best friends back in Ireland works in air traffic control. And when he was training, part of what they had to do, and I believe still like it's regularly kind of reinforced, is simulations of what to do when the computer systems go down. And they actually use paper strips with the airplanes. So they kind of have the vectors of the planes, and they have a way to manage the air traffic control. If the electricity is completely gone, everything's wiped out, they can literally go back to pens and manage the air traffic using that. I mean, it's obviously not as elegant as you know, being able to look at a screen where it all happens magically, not magically, but you know, easily. but you know, it's a similar thing. But yeah, definitely take your point around the downstream effects. I think that is incredibly incredibly worrying.
And as you said, I mean, this is a bigger story around things like supply chain that we've spoken about many times, unfortunately, and the notion of how you introduce risk into your whole environment now, right, and what that means. But also we've seen here in Australia and New Zealand, you know, that we've not been immune to attacks of this type as well, with the local providers being pinged over the last couple of years as well.
Yeah, definitely. You saw that with Barwon District Health Board. Again, you know, stuff was impacted there, surgeries, appointments, checkups, and then over in New Zealand, Waikato, probably saying that wrong, so apologies on the pronunciation. But Waikato District Health Board again back in May 2021. So this stuff is happening all around the world, and health, you know, health unfortunately is one of those incredibly lucrative targets for the obvious reason that there's people's lives and health at risk. So the stakes are much, much higher than they would be if you just, you know, you encrypted somebody who's running a delivery service or, you know, removalists or something like that, where, okay, it's a massive hassle for the business, but, you know, no one's life is going to be massively impacted. Whereas I think when you get to the point where it's critical infrastructure, or if it's healthcare related, immediately the stakes are raised and hard. And then you get to the point where, well, you know, does it make sense to pay a ransom? Well, if somebody's life is on the line, then potentially it does.
Yeah, so many implications of it, and definitely one that, you know, we definitely do never like to see anything, as you say, but in this space and against, you know, a provider like the NHS that is so prolific across, you know, the UK, right? So it's like this is, you know, impacting, you know, so many thousands of people. So it's a terrible environment, and we wish them all the best to, you know, quickly recover and get back on track, that's for sure. Finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. The first news item is the warning from the ACCC of suspicious messages as the Hi Mum scam spikes.
Yeah, this is I love the name. Horrible thing, but yeah, kind of a funny name. Yeah, I mean, these are basically ones where you get a phone message, and the social engineering here is that they're pretending to be somebody from your family. So, you know, that's the Hi Mum. So, you know, family member or friend saying that they need help, and it'll tend to be, I'm on a different number, and, you know, because of the big emergency, I'm not using the number that you would know me to be on. So it is Mum, but, you know, please come urgently or send some money because blah, blah, blah. It's happening through WhatsApp, as is so often the case, as well as SMS. I mean, we see them all the time. I don't know about you, Dan, but like the really odd messages you get from somebody saying, oh, I've got your number, I don't know how I have it. And they're always of a certain look, and shall we say, you know, the photos look a certain way, but it's clearly social engineering for probably lonely men who kind of go, well, I don't know, but hopefully hopefully we met in a bar sometime. But, you know, the Haimon scams kind of, you know, fall into that category of, you know, random contacts from somebody pretending to be somebody that they're not, in this case, a family member or friend. And then they'll start asking for things like personal information. So they'll ask for maybe photos, social media stuff, or money to pay a bill, et cetera, or, you know, they need to replace their phone. So can you send some money because they need to not buy a new phone? You would hope, and, you know, this is probably me being naive, but you would hope that most people wouldn't fall for this. And even as I'm saying that, I'm probably realizing that some people will. But, you know, fingers crossed, it's one of those ones where people would at least double check with another family member. And, oh, no, mom's here. I don't know what you're talking about. Or they would try and ring their mom on their phone. And, you know, when she picks up, you realize it's a scam.
Indeed. I was going to say, probably just give them a call, right? Might be the best way to do things and really, like, verify that, because if it feels, you know, a bit off, it probably is, right? So definitely err on the side of caution for sure. Next is a story that a large-scale phishing campaign dubbed Octopus has wreaked havoc, compromising more than 130 organizations around the world.
Yeah, it's this was a big one, actually. And there was one organization actually in Australia as well that got popped. So big companies, Twilio, Best Buy, DoorDash. You know, people would be familiar with, so certainly Twilio and DoorDash, maybe Best Buy a little bit less in Australia. But basically what was going on here was the attackers got 10,000 credentials, logon credentials, and they were basically imitating the SSO, so the single sign-on service from Okta, and that was their kind of way in. So what happened was the phishing campaign, they sent a huge amount of text messages, and what would happen was if people were going to the link, it's actually redirecting them to a phishing site, and that site was kind of a man-in-the-middle type thing where they were manipulating that side in the middle. But it points to a lot of the problems we're seeing with, you know, one-time passwords and, you know, the version of MFA where it's a, we'll send you a code and then put that in to log on to the site. More and more we're seeing these examples of very well-executed man-in-the-middle attacks where, you know, an example might be, if I'm trying to compromise you, I send you the phishing campaign message, you click on the link and it looks legit, and you open your MFA app on your phone, you put in the one-time password and you've given your creds already, and all I'm doing is just redirecting those to the real site you think you're logging on. Kind of looks like legit on your side, but actually now I've got access. And in some cases, you know, depending on what you're doing, and I'm not necessarily talking about this Octopus. What a great name, by the way, Octopus. I'm not talking about this one in particular, but what that could lead to, you know, if you've put in your MFA code, I mean, I might be in a position then to start redirecting things and setting up, well, a good example actually is in comms where you can set up a BCC to start looking at, you know, all the communications from within an email account as one example. So you can start to do some really interesting things when you're using the kind of one-time password. So, one-time authentication codes generated by MFA apps. So, and again, you know, if we're back to FIDO, you know, a lot of that stuff starts to get helped through that.
Yeah, definitely a big impact. Like we said, 130 organizations, but 10,000 people around the world impacted as well. So certainly a big fallout from the Octopus scam. And finally, the Australian Signals Directorate, commonly referred to as the ASD, is celebrating being Australia's cyber agency for 75 years. And they've released a commemorative 50-cent coin with multiple imprinted codes embedded on the coin. But the code may not have been all that hard to be broken. Tell us, Gar, what's happened here?
Well, it's a funny one because maybe the code wasn't hard to be broken, or we've just got an incredibly clever 14-year-old because they were able to crack it in just over an hour. This one just made me so happy. You know, those stories so often, you know, we're talking about horrible things like the NHS getting popped into, just, you know, gross and depressing. And then this is just such a happy story. The ASD produced this 50-cent coin. It's very pretty, by the way. I'm not into coins, but I'm looking at this thing and I wouldn't mind having one of those in my drawer. It is quite lovely. Looks like there's kind of a vignette cipher around the outside, and it's just very sort of an elegant design. But they put it out there with four levels of encryption. And this 14-year-old within an hour was able to sort of prove that they'd sort of gotten through those four layers. The ASD have then since come out and says that there's actually a fifth level of encryption and that nobody's broken that one yet. But the ASD director, Rachel Noble, was saying that, you know, they're probably going to try and recruit this person, this 14-year-old in Tasmania, to come and work for them. It's just such a happy story. And it points to the talent again in this country. You and I have talked about it so many times. There's very, very clever people in cyber and clearly in code cracking as well. And actually, you know what this reminds me of? Did you guys get the movie The Last Starfighter? Was that a movie that made it over here? It's back in the 80s.
Well, not that I remember, but...
it was around the time of The Explorers, like probably early 80s. Daryl was another one. The Last Starfighter, there's this kid who, you know, was kind of very average life, and there's this arcade game near where he lives, and he plays it, you know, and he's incredibly good, gets to the point where he beats it, and, you know, the night he beats it, this limo arrives, and it turns out basically the arcade game was a recruiting mechanism for... like Starfleets, you know, where they go off and fight aliens, and amazingly cool film. If people can find it, it's from the early 80s, so you kind of have to see it through that lens. But I remember just wishing every time I sat down on my Atari 2600 that, you know, some limo was going to come and take me away to do the cool stuff in space. But good on this kid. I think this is just such a happy story.
Agree. Great story to end on for this episode. It's a lot of fun, and it would be interesting to see if he gets level 5 of the code cracked shortly. It seems like he's been set a challenge now, that's for sure. Well, thank you, Gar. Appreciate all your insights as always. Who do you have for us as our special guest for next week?
This is a really good one. We have Peter Cronius, who's the founder of CyberMinds. I say it's good because I ended up talking to Peter for about half an hour after we stopped recording, because he's just an incredibly interesting person. He's got a great bio. I'm not even going to give the bio because he actually tells it on the pod, and it's just awesome, his background and his story. But he's basically a sort of globally recognized authority on cyber. And he's a guy who's actually informed a lot of the policy that affects how we use the internet even today, right? So it's like he's that kind of guy. We talk about lots of different stuff, but Peter, as you know, you guys are well connected. He's working these days on the kind of humans that support cyber, and that is such an incredibly important area. We've had other people on, you know, talking about the ideas of stress and burnout and how to deal with that. Peter's actually solving that problem, and I think it's an important problem that he is solving. So we, you know, we're on there talking about, you know, how people suffer from burnout, what the effects of that are, the importance of mental health for, you know, our own well-being, but obviously then how that rolls up into organizational performance. But he talks about the work that he's doing with CyberMinds, and it feels very important, and is having some incredibly good results.
Indeed, yeah. Really looking forward to hearing from Peter, and that topic of mental health and well-being within cyber, so critically important. So until next week, if you would like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump onto getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the latest articles, including a full wrap-up of all security stories from August with our This Month in Security article, and how leaving staff to their own devices can be a winner if you do it right. And finally, a look into how the education sector is a hot target for scammers, but it can't fight back. So thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.